Right now on the Daily Debrief, NFL wide receiver Antonio Brown now faces a federal rape lawsuit. Also, defense experts question interrogation tactics in the case of an Ohio woman accused of murdering her baby 2 days after her high school prom.
Both of these comments indicate that the suspect will receive zero punishment.
The state pushes back with a checklist suggesting guilt. Plus,
I asked her to please leave me alone.
That's what this husband told police when questioned about the disappearance of his girlfriend. What happened to Heather Elvis? The Daily Debrief recaps today in court. It's Wednesday, September 11th.
And welcome to the debrief, day two of defense witnesses in the case of an Ohio teen accused of murdering her newborn baby 2 days after her high school prom. Prosecutors say Brooke Schuyler Richardson learned she was pregnant at the doctor's office, made no follow-up appointments, and did nothing to prepare for her baby's arrival. The state says she then killed her child after giving birth alone at home. Richardson says the baby was stillborn and that she secretly buried its remains without telling people because she feared backlash. Four of the five original charges remain. The top charge is still aggravated murder and the bottom charge is still abuse of a corpse, but the judge threw out the fourth charge, tampering with evidence, after the state's case in chief. With me tonight to talk about this case are attorneys Anthony Tall and Linda Kenny Bodden. I want you to listen to this next series of clips. Three people who knew the defendant testified that they couldn't picture her killing a child, but they also admitted on cross-examination that they don't think the defendant would have hidden a pregnancy or given birth in secret.
You didn't know that she was pregnant, is that right?
That is correct.
And you didn't know that she was actively concealing her pregnancy, did you?
No, I did not.
And you didn't know that at the time that she had given birth in the middle of the night, alone, and then taken that baby and buried it out in the backyard, did you?
I had no clue, nothing had happened.
Were you shocked to know that?
Yes.
Why were you shocked?
Because the Skylar that I know would not do that.
So would you have even been able to fathom or consider that she would have had the ability to conceal a baby, deliver it in the middle of the night, and then bury that baby in the backyard? Would you even be able to fathom that from Skylar?
Never.
So is it fair to say that we don't always know what people are capable of?
The Skylar I know would not do that, and I firmly believe that.
The fact that she would have gotten pregnant, concealed it from her parents, delivered alone in the middle of the night, and then instead of, you know, going to the hospital or calling anyone, taking that baby out to the backyard, digging a pile into the ground or in the ground and then placing her baby in there, prior to knowing that about her, would you have ever thought that she was capable of that?
I mean, when everything came out, I was shocked. Yes, I was shocked. But I don't know.
Did you have any inclination, any sign that she was pregnant?
I did not at all.
Have you seen a full-term pregnant woman?
I have, twice, up close.
And Skylar at no point looked full-term?
Not at all.
You've had over 3,000 students. What makes you remember Skylar more than 2 years later? Why does she stand out to you?
Well, most of the students I've had were all really good kids, but they have a tendency to blend together in my memory. It's the nature of the business. You have so many students. You have some that might excel in academics, just be strong students. And then sometimes you have students that are just genuinely good people that care about others. But rarely do you have some that fall into both categories. And Skylar Richardson was one of them.
Let's bring the panel into this discussion right now. Let's bring Anthony Tall in. We've got a classmate, a teacher, and a coworker basically saying, she's a good person. We don't think she would have done anything like kill her baby. And you watch the prosecution attack back on that.
Yeah, well, I think what the defense has done is set up this ideal and painted this picture of a person who no one and the people who are closest to her who see her every day, her best friend, her teacher, none of this behavior, she had ever exhibited any of this behavior. And if it did, it would have to have been aberrational. But I think these are good character witnesses.
Linda Kenny Bunn, it's rare to have character evidence like this in a case.
Yes, absolutely. Most of the people you represent in a criminal courtroom have done something bad in their life, or they're older enough that it would be construed as bad. So you don't have this opportunity to bring people in to say what good character she has.
It opens up all sorts of doors for the defense to get knocked by the prosecution. It wasn't as bad in this case because the defendant's so young. But the defense did ask an interrogation expert to tell jurors what the defense thinks went horribly wrong during the defendant's police interrogation.
The officers in the July 20th interrogation of the defendant used a very aggressive version of the Reed technique.
Can you explain that to the jury?
So right at the outset, they told Skyler that with medical scientific certainty, her account where the baby was stillborn was false. That is standard confrontation. And then they advanced any number of minimization themes. They led on that the main purpose of this interrogation was a burial for the baby, a proper burial. They told her that they knew she didn't harm the baby deliberately. They said that she had been alone and in shock. These are all fairly typical minimization themes, but they went beyond that. They made two statements that I found particularly problematic. Lieutenant Fain said to her, "It's not as if we're suddenly going to jump up and judge you and say you're going to jail." And Detective Carter said to her, "You just tell us everything and then we can move on." Both of these comments indicate that the suspect will receive zero punishment if she confesses. Not a light sentence, not a benign treatment, but zero punishment. And that is an extreme and particularly troubling minimization tactic.
And that's it problematic, in your view, for what reason?
Because it can break down an innocent person and lead him or her to confess.
Meanwhile, a psychologist gave the defendant a diagnosis which basically says she struggles to stand up to authority figures. He had similar opinions, though, of that interrogation.
What I observed is here were two interrogators who took her hand. Here is a young girl who's in a very vulnerable situation, who's under extreme stress, who doesn't know what's going on, who in a sense has learned to believe that the police, the authorities, are there to protect her, to keep her safe. And by taking her hand, and by continually using leading questions, leading statement, they attempted Skyler to say things that she knew were false. I read in the transcript about her being force-fed, about her setting fire to a baby, her being forced fed, about hearing a sound. Even though she adamantly said no. And that, in one sense, is remarkable for Skyler to have said no. But unfortunately, she was worn down.
On cross-examination, that psychologist was forced to look at a checklist from another study, which the prosecution used to suggest the defendant fits the profile of a person who would kill her baby.
Please. You would agree that this article that's now reviewing 40 years worth of studies and literature on neonaticide says that the majority of infants killed in the first day are born out of a hospital, usually at the woman's home.
Well, that's what you're reporting. I wonder about the language. I wonder about the internal, external validity of this study. I haven't reviewed this study. I'm not an expert on this. But I have to be cautious in terms of looking at research and basically saying I agree or disagree. I mean, it's easy to get a checklist and basically check it off and believe that. But it's really not fair. It's not reasonable. And to make any type of conclusion based upon that, it's frightening.
The hallmark example of neonaticide is that the newborn is unwanted, and so the woman, after concealing the pregnancy for 9 months, gives birth alone, and then kills the newborn via non-weapon methods such as suffocation, strangulation, or drowning.
See, you're asking me to comment something. You're giving me a very broad generalization. As a psychologist, it behooves me to look at alternative explanations when somebody presents me with information.
Isn't it possible in this case, that we're not just dealing with an individual that has a dependent personality disorder, but that she is also someone that engaged in the act of neonaticide, and that because of the similarity in characteristics, the act of neonaticide is being disregarded or overlooked altogether? The two are not mutually exclusive, correct, Doctor?
Correct.
Okay, let's go back to the panel on this one. Linda Kenny Button, can you convict somebody based on checking off a checklist that you see in a study that the expert that the defense called never even himself looked at?
Sure. The jurors may be prone to convict her because they don't like the fact that a child they believe died or was killed or didn't get the right fetal attention prior to the birth.
Linda, look at the checklist. Getting up there as a prosecutor and trying to say as a trial tactic that, oh, well, this sounds like her, this sounds like her, therefore she did what this outcome is.
I didn't say I don't think it was outrageous, but I think a jury can buy it. I actually pulled the article. All they had to do was call the person who wrote the article, and they find out that's not what the person was talking about. So I think it was an outrageous use of a checklist.
Anthony, bottom line here, the defense expert said this is not reasonable. In other words, Linda agrees with the expert in saying that it's frightening to make a conclusion like that. Do you agree?
I agree. And then one thing that stands out to me through that whole exchange was you had a prosecutor using the word possible. Is it possible? That's usually what defense attorneys say. These prosecutors have been beat at every turn of this case, and it's just amazing to see the outlawing that's happened.
Strong opinions there. The defense also today called a forensic pathologist who disagreed with the state's finding that the baby died from homicide. But the prosecutor got the expert to admit he might not be able to see some types of violent injuries by looking at the infant's bones alone. Here is both direct and cross-examination.
My opinion is the cause of death is undetermined is because there is, in my opinion, after examination of the remains, there is no identifiable evidence of any cause of death, let alone any traumatic cause of death. There's no evidence of the child was alive at birth. It's not possible to say that the child died of a natural death. It's not possible to say that the child committed suicide. It's not possible to say that the child died of an accident. In my opinion, it's not possible to say that the child died of the manner of death is homicide.
But you would also agree with me that you would not expect to see violent injury just to the bones of this child. If the child was suffocated, is that fair to say?
There would not be any evidence of suffocation, no.
Okay. And there would not be any evidence just from examining the bones of whether this child may have been drowned in the water. Is that fair to say?
That's correct.
This battle of the experts will resume. We anticipate closing arguments in this case tomorrow. And still ahead here on The Debrief, a federal lawsuit alleging rape against an NFL wide receiver. Plus, we're going to head back to South Carolina for the trial of a husband accused of helping his wife make his girlfriend disappear. A federal jury has convicted a woman from China for unlawfully entering President Trump's private club in Florida. Yujing Zhang chose to represent herself at trial. She was arrested earlier this year at Mar-a-Lago after she was caught carrying flash drives, and she claimed she was there to attend an event. She was also found guilty of lying to a federal officer and faces up to 6 years in prison. An NFL wide receiver has been hit with a federal civil lawsuit alleging rape. Antonio Brown's accuser says the attacks happened in Pittsburgh and Miami and even went back to time she and the pro footballer spent together in college. So far, the police are not involved. The NFL attempted to speak to the accuser, but she refused, saying she's going to be married this weekend. Brown says it's a financial shakedown and that the accuser has been after him for some time to help fund a business venture. Let's bring Linda and Anthony in to discuss this case. Anthony, you've been following this. What do you make of the core accusations here?
I don't think they're credible. I think that I would assume that one of her first venues would be to go to the police or set up some type of criminal investigation. I'm usually suspicious when there's a civil suit filed immediately right away.
Linda Kenny Button, we're in an age where people are being told, look, believe accusers. Do you agree with the assessment or do you disagree?
I think in a criminal section, a criminal context, you have to still let the burden of proof apply, and you have to look at each case individually, Aaron, because there may be some claims here. Maybe she had a consensual relationship, but maybe there were some claims of rape that are true. We don't know. We simply don't know.
Discovery is going to be messy, potentially, then?
Very messy, especially since the police may now open an investigation if they hadn't had one, and he may have Fifth Amendment rights. So it could be really messy.
And on it'll go. And now let's go to day two of the trial of Sidney Maurer. He's the South Carolina man charged in connection with the disappearance of a woman named Heather Elvis. Maurer was dating Elvis, and Elvis has been missing since December 2013, almost 6 years ago. Sidney Maurer's wife, Tammy, seen here in a separate trial, was convicted last fall of actually kidnapping Heather Elvis. During a police interview, the defendant, this time around, Sidney, said his wife placed him on so-called probation after finding out about his affair. The wife would handcuff Sidney to his bed at night and hold on to his phone. Sidney Maurer told investigators that on the night Heather went missing, he finished working around 1 o'clock in the morning. He left with his wife Tammy and went to get gasoline and a pregnancy test.
I'm almost positive I got a pregnancy test that night. I don't know if it was in that order.
For your wife?
Yes. It was, from that
was it at the gas station?
No, it was at Walmart, actually.
Was your wife with you?
Yes.
The whole time?
Yeah, she was with me the whole time.
Okay.
And then we went down, went to 501, because I went to show her a car and SUV set up like a sleigh reindeer type thing. So I went to show her that, and oh, we were Broadway to get sex in the parking lot.
Okay.
That's the graphic part I was talking about.
Okay. No, it was in the parking lot.
Right.
And what type of car were you driving?
Black F-150. And then we went to Conway, we had sex on a different parking lot.
So you parked back there also?
Yes.
What time do you think that was?
Probably 2.
2?
2:30 maybe.
Did you drive straight home or did you go somewhere else?
I'm trying to remember. I know I left there. Seems like I cut over to 544 and went down that way. I'm trying to remember where I went. If we went home then, we may have gone home after that. I can't remember.
Maurer told police he spoke to Heather Elvis at around 3 or 4 in the morning after all of that, and he said she was the one who wanted to meet up with him. He claims he told her that he was working to fix his marriage and just couldn't see her anymore.
There was a phone call made to Heather that night from a payphone at the gas station on 10th Avenue.
Okay.
But we have video from that.
Okay.
Did you try calling her just a minute?
Okay.
A second? You sure?
Maybe.
Okay, how about we start again?
I did. I called her from
okay,
the phone.
Let's start from the start again. Because
I know.
I don't know you. You don't know me.
I know. In the whole story, everything's legit.
Okay. Let's go back to the part where it stopped being legit.
I did call her on the payphone.
Okay. And what did you say?
I asked her to please leave me alone because she had been leaving notes on her car when I was at work. You need to call me.
Okay.
And that's it. There's no signature.
That was like November-ish.
November. No. That was beginning of December. That's why I called her that night from the payphone. Please, can you stop?
Okay.
Just stop.
How long was that conversation?
A minute and a half, 2 minutes.
Or five, 4 minutes, maybe?
I guess it could have been that long.
Okay. It doesn't take 4 minutes to tell her to stop leaving me alone.
Well, no. But I mean, she, you know, talked back and said, hey, you know, what's the problem type thing, and I'm like, just leave me alone, please.
Okay, police asked Maurer if he would be willing to take a lie detector test, even though they're usually not admissible. He said he would not without a lawyer because he doesn't like confrontation. He later admitted that he was the one who actually contacted Heather Elvis.
Where was your wife when you called her?
Sitting in the truck.
Okay, so she wasn't sitting next to you?
No. But I mean,
your wife knows you were going to call her?
No.
But she saw you on the phone?
I don't know if she did or not.
What did you tell your wife you were going to do?
I told her I was running in the store real quick.
Hey, where did you park?
Like across the street.
To call and say, leave me alone to a woman.
Yes.
You need to start over.
Yeah, let's start over.
That ain't flying, boss.
What do you mean it's flying?
Because I can't see you running.
It's across
the road,
across the other street. Literally, right across the street.
Why?
To use the phone. To tell her.
Your cell phone?
Because I didn't want my wife to know I was calling her.
To tell her to leave you alone? That's
yes,
what doesn't make
me and my wife discussed that it was
what
no contact.
I think you called her and said, because you were pissed off at your wife about something. And
I haven't been mad at my wife in 2 months.
Okay.
Over anything.
Well, the friend that was sitting next to Heather said that you made comments about not wanting to be with your wife anymore. And maybe it was just something you wanted to get off your chest to Heather, but that's what she heard. She said Heather's eyes opened up like maybe things are going to work again.
I'm not leaving my wife.
Well, did you say something like that? That
I
made
had no intention of leaving my wife.
But did you say something that maybe thought that you wanted to start a relationship again?
I did not.
Okay, back now to attorneys Linda Kenny Bodden and Anthony Tull. So, Anthony, look, this goes completely against the state's theory of the case, and obviously the jury has to reconcile the two, but was this guy really waiting for her to call, and then she asks him to get together, and then she suddenly disappears, and he claims he's having sex in a parking lot? Did I hear that straight?
I thought so. I thought he said he was having it with his wife, too. Is that correct?
Yeah, and then later the girlfriend disappears.
Yeah, it seems a little weird to me. And then the fact that he recanted and went on to say that he eventually called her to break up with her at 2 in the morning doesn't make sense to me at all.
Linda, is this believable?
No, it's absolutely not. And I'm a defense attorney. They may, you know, they have means, motives, opportunity. The state may not have proof, but boy, do I think that he did it? Yeah, on this evidence, absolutely. He has sex with his wife at 2:30. At 3:14, right, he talks to Heather Elvis, and then she is never heard from again.
And she goes to this boat launch, Anthony, that the state described as this vacant, dark place where nobody goes at 3 or 4 in the morning, and that's where Heather Elvis supposedly went.
Yeah, it doesn't look good for the defense here, I'll just say that.
You know, and the big question is, where did Heather Elvis go? Linda, nobody really knows. The only thing the prosecution can say is, we don't know where she is. It's
right.
Been, what, almost 6 years now?
That's right. You know, but I had a cousin who was killed when I was young, and the body was never found, and the state of New Jersey convicted the person who was a serial murderer. So it can be done.
And Anthony, look, I mean, how do you go forward as a defense attorney? You've got this interrogation. You've got the defendant, at least in some opinion, spinning his wheels, trying to come up with theories. Where do you go?
Well, you're basically going to shift the whole blame to the wife, and you're going to drill on the fact that they don't have the body.
Linda agrees with that.
I absolutely agree with that, although I have a feeling, I kind of think from the beginning that this case didn't go down the same way the state does. I think she may have been kidnapped from her apartment and then taken, and that call was actually from the husband to the wife at the payphone, and then they met at the launch.
So many facts to straighten out here. We're going to be watching both trials as we move forward. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you.
And thanks to those of you watching along with us. Our live trial coverage resumes tomorrow at 9 o'clock Eastern. The Debrief back here at 5 o'clock. We'll see you then.